Okay, I've been told that we should get started, so thank you to everybody for coming. I don't know why it is always so much more nerve-wracking to give a talk in front of people you know than you don't know. You can stand in front of a room of 300 people, and if you don't know them, it's fine, but when you know them, it's a bit more difficult. I'm presenting this session on what was called healthy living, which is really going to be a look at some of the research that we're doing in the school around the interaction between diet and chronic disease. I think I got primarily selected because when they were looking for somebody else, everybody else was on holiday, and I was foolish enough to answer the phone, so that's why I'm here. But I'm very much presenting on behalf of all my colleagues in nutritional sciences. The other thing I should apologise for the start is that for the first time in 20-odd years, I've managed to get Fresh's flu 2 weeks before the Fresh's even arrive. So if my voice packs in, then that's what it's about. As Paul's just said, but hopefully I can infect them when they come rather than the other way around. So that's a good thing. Life used to be so much more simple than it is at the moment. This is one of my favourite slides. I've used it so much now that I think virtually everyone has seen it. So this might be its last outing, but I'm told that another Crisco one is definitely real. I'm told the one on the left is an actual advertisement from the United States, from the Lard Information Council, telling us that if we eat plenty of lard, we'll be fit and healthy and happy, and we'll all run along the beach, be laughing with our families. The one on the other side, the Crisco advert, is quite interesting because it's an advert for the first, one of the first makes of hydrogenated vegetable oil. And the history of hydrogenated vegetable oil, apparently, is that we used to use animal fat, tallow, as candles, and they therefore invented a way of taking vegetable fat and converting it into a solid wax that we could actually use and burn as candles. But then somebody went and invented electricity, and all of that technology was in danger of being wasted. So somebody had the bright idea that it looked like lard, so why didn't we start eating it? And there that's where we got our first margarines and our shortenings, and little did we know that it was, if anything, going to be worse than the actual animal fats in its effects on our health. Then this guy came along and ruined everything. This is Ansel Keys, who is credited with some of the first conclusive demonstrations of showing us that eating a diet which is rich in saturated fat raises our plasma cholesterol, and having a raised plasma cholesterol is directly associated to our risk of developing heart disease. There's two major pieces of work that Keyes is credited with. The first one is he was the leader of what was called the Seven Countries Study, where basically they went, as the name suggests, into seven different countries around the world, different towns within those countries, and they measured people's dietary intake. So they measured the amount of saturated fat they're taking in, and they measured their blood cholesterol. And they found that they fitted more or less on a straight line. The more saturated fat you're eating along the x-axis there, the higher your blood cholesterol is along the y-axis. This was followed up, and indeed those people who had the highest cholesterol and the highest fat intake were having the most heart attacks as well. Now, much of that data has been argued about for the last 50 years or so. The fact that he has been accused of doctoring the data, of taking certain countries out. We have the so-called French paradox, where the French eat lots of saturated fat, but they don't have the same level of cholesterol, and so on and so forth. And people continue to argue today how valid that data is. But the other thing that Keyes did was a whole series of metabolic ward feeding studies, where he took people into hospital, changed their diet, and looked at the impact of that change on their plasma cholesterol. Because they were in hospital, they had to eat what they were given. They couldn't cheat. So it's some of the best data still around that we've got at the moment. And he tried changing the amount of saturated fat in the diet, and he tried the amount of unsaturated fat, the amount of cholesterol, and he put all of this data together, and at the bottom of that slide there you have something called the Keyes equation. And this is an equation which is used to predict the effect of changing the amount and type of fat in your diet on your plasma cholesterol. Since then, literally thousands of studies have been done trying to refine that. And the data that I show you on the slide there is what's called a meta-analysis of 60 of the best trials that have been done in over that period, putting all that data together. And rather than showing you an equation, which doesn't mean a lot, we put it into graphical form there, which actually predicts what would happen. And the prediction here is if you take some of the carbohydrates, some of the sugar out of your diet, and replace it with fat and different sorts of fats, what's going to happen? What Keyes didn't know back in the early days was that, in fact, the cholesterol that's circulating in your blood is carried in several types of particles, and two of those particles are critical in heart disease. One is what you'll hear in the media called bad cholesterol, that's your LDL cholesterol. The other one is what you hear in the media is called good cholesterol, and that's your HDL cholesterol. There's no such thing as bad and good cholesterol. Cholesterol is a molecule. It doesn't matter which it's in, it's the same molecule. But the particles that carry it in your blood are the ones which are good and bad. The bad ones, the LDL, are the particles which carry it around in your blood and deposit that cholesterol in your arteries and cause you to have a heart attack, so-called atherosclerosis. The good guys, the HDL cholesterol, do the opposite. They pick that cholesterol back up from the artery walls, they take it to the liver, and from the liver it can be excreted and you can get rid of it. And many people believe now that the balance between the LDL and the HDL, the good and the bad, is what predicts whether one person's going to have a heart attack compared to another person. So looking at the effects of fat on the different bad and good, or the LDL and the HDL, you can see that saturated fatty acids here increase the bad cholesterol. They also increase the good cholesterol a little bit, but the increase in the bad is so much higher than the good that overall they're bad for you. Now, the unsaturated if you look at the intake of red meat, rich in saturated fat, whether it's beef or lamb, you can see that since the mid-70s, consumption of red meat has gone down substantially. If you look at our consumption of butter, you can see that that's gone down quite dramatically, although it started falling in the mid-70s and got to a low in the early 90s. Even more remarkable is our changing in habits of the type of milk we drink. Back in the mid-70s, we'd hardly heard of reduced-fat milk, whether it be skim milk or semi-skim milk. And then, as it became common and commonly available, you can see we've dramatically reduced our intake of whole milk, and we've increased our intake of skim milk. However, more remarkably, despite these changes that we've brought about in our diet, we have stubbornly refused to give up saturated fat intake. There was some movement between about the middle of the 1970s and early 1990s, and since then we have stayed at about 13 or 14% of our total energy intake as saturated fat, stubbornly above the 10% which has been recommended. So why, if we've changed our meat intake, if we've stopped eating butter, if we've stopped eating full-fat milk, why is our saturated fat intake still so high? Well, unfortunately, the fat that we take out of the milk when we make skim milk doesn't necessarily get thrown away. It goes back into the food chain in other foods. It goes into processed foods. We've reduced our intake of full-fat milk, but we've increased our intake of cream. And all sorts of different processed foods, takeaways, for example. And basically, we have replaced those sources of saturated fat with different sources of saturated fat, and overall, we've hardly reached our target. So if that's the case, what's happened to the incidence of heart disease over that period? Well, the good news, and I feel that the news that perhaps isn't really talked about enough, is that it has decreased quite dramatically. Even without taking notice of Ansel Keys and everybody else about changing our saturated fat intake, year on year, we have reduced the deaths in people under the age of 75 from heart disease, all the way from the mid-70s, all the way up to, I think this data goes up to 2007. Now, I started my PhD in 1978 working in this area, so I'd like to take full credit for all of these decreases year on year. But I don't think I'd get away with that somehow. So if we haven't changed our diet, if we haven't responded with these changes which are reducing our plasma cholesterol, why, year on year on year, have we seen this decrease in heart disease? Well, I can't give you the full answer, but I can give you part of the answer. This was an analysis which was done looking at the difference in heart disease between 1981 and the year 2000. Looking at all the factors that have changed. And there's one single factor there that is by far the biggest change in the so-called risk factors for heart disease from them all, and it's that top one. Between 1981 and 2000, smoking decreased by 34% in this country, and it's estimated that by that single change, 48% of the decrease in heart disease is directly attributable to the decrease in smoking. It's a major success story. We did something right for once. We got people to stop smoking, a significant number of people to stop smoking, and you can see directly the consequences of that. We've had a significant reduction in the number of deaths. We need more people to stop smoking, obviously, but it is one of the successes of public health campaigns, if you like, in terms of getting people to reduce an activity which is bad for them. But a more modest reduction in the overall population blood pressure of about 10%. Plasma cholesterol over that period, it's estimated contributed about another 10% decrease, so not particularly strong effect of that. But there's three things at the bottom there which have become rather worrying. While smoking, blood pressure and cholesterol have gone down to various amounts, and that's improved our risk. I think deprivation refers to social deprivation, which has improved, and that's improved our risk. Those benefits have been offset by some adverse changes in some other things. And that's what most nutritionists and most people in interest in public health are particularly concerned about at the moment. A decrease in physical activity of 30% between 1980 and 2000, a massive 186% change increase in obesity, and a 65% increase in diabetes have all been predicted to have partly offset the benefits of those other risk factors. And that was in 2000. Things have got steadily worse since then. And really, the major public health problem at the moment that most people foresee in the Western, the industrial world, is this so-called epidemic of obesity and diseases related to it. That is the most recent data I could find for the population body mass index for the UK in men and women. Body mass index is a measure of obesity. It's your weight in kilograms divided by your height in meters squared. And it's a scale which is universally used to describe people's weight. In general, when this classification was invented, if you like, having a BMI between 18.5 and 25 was regarded as normal. If you're under 18.5, you're regarded as underweight. Between 25 and 30, you're regarded as overweight. 30 to 40, obese. And over 40, you were seriously obese, you were morbidly obese. If you look at where we are now, you see that, particularly in males, that classification is probably a little bit misleading. There's only the youngest group there, the 16 to 24-year-olds, where the so-called normal classification is in the majority of people. So in young men between 16 and 24, about 60% of them fell into the 18.5 to 25. As you move into the older groups of men, in every single group, the predominant group now is the so-called overweight one. With increasing numbers as you get older in the obese groups. Women, in general, seem to stay slightly leaner for longer, and that normal group is the predominant one right up to about the age of 34, and then we start to change. But in general, the number of women who are classified as obese, again, is quite similar to that in men. If you look at all of that data put together, the latest, this data in 2006, and the estimates which are going to come out more recently, I think are going to say it's even worse, about a quarter of our population in this country are now classified as being obese. What I want to talk about is the consequences of that. Does it really matter? But first of all, I think it's worthwhile talking about why we're getting fat. And this is an exercise I did in the summer with the food science summer school students who came. I won't make you sit down and do all the calculations and tell me what the answers are, but I asked them to think about how much weight you'd put on if you ate 4 Mars bars a week above what your normal requirements are. So the extra you're eating is only 4 Mars bars. Half a Mars bar a day for 6 days a week, and then you'll have a blowout on a Sunday and have a full Mars bar. What happens if you do that? And I also asked them to work out how would they prevent the weight gain that was associated with it. And I think most of them were quite surprised when they did the calculations, looking at the energy content of a Mars bar. I've got nothing against Mars bars, by the way. I just chose it as a common currency. Looking at the amount of energy you've got in a Mars bar and the amount of energy that you have in a gram of your fat, your adipose tissue. And it worked out that over a year, just eating 4 extra Mars bars a week, you would put on about 12.7 pounds. If you did that over 5 years, you'd put on 4.5 stone. If you wanted to avoid that, you'd have to do the equivalent exercise of running between 12 and 16 miles a week. And when you look at that, that is not unusual, I think, for anybody to be consuming over their actual requirements. And when you look at that, I think the question that you start to ask yourself is not why are so many people fat, but why doesn't everybody get fat? How do we know how much to eat? How do we know we're not over-consuming just by that small amount and getting fat over the years? Well, in fact, most animals and us have an inbuilt mechanism for detecting how much food we need and regulating our appetite to try and match that. And you can see it beautifully in many rodent species. It is very hard to get a normal rat to actually overeat. If you increase the energy content of his diet, he reduces his food intake. There's all sorts of different chemical signals being produced by many tissues in the body, including the brain and his adipose tissue and everything, which will actually tell him, I've had enough now, stop eating, that will do. And we know that because there are several mutants, two of which are shown here. This one you can probably see better is here. These mutants either cannot produce some of these chemical signals, and the one we're talking about here is a chemical called leptin, which you may have heard of, or their receptors which recognise the leptin don't work properly. And when we get these mutations, they can no longer control their food intake. And as a result of that, a guy who should look like that ends up looking like that. And when we discovered that, there was a lot of excitement. Have we found the reason why some people get fat and some people don't? Unfortunately, the answer is no. There's a very, very small number of people who have a genetic abnormality in, say, the leptin receptor or in the production of leptin who are very prone to obesity. But for the vast majority of people who are overweight and obese, I'm afraid the answer is much more simple. We have found a way to pack as much energy as possible into our food and make it as palatable as possible. If you think of a Mars bar or any other chocolate bar, it's very rich in fat, it's very rich in sugar, in sucrose, it's highly palatable. We like the taste, and every gram of it is packed full of calories. And basically, by doing that to our food, we've managed to overcome many of these natural senses that we have in our body to tell us we've eaten enough and we overeat. Put that together with the fact that we're doing less and less exercise, and unfortunately, the answer is incredibly simple. We eat too much and we don't do enough activity, and that's why as a population we're getting fat. Does it matter? Well, we do know one thing. We've known one thing for a long time, and it's illustrated very nicely from this data from the United States. You get similar data from anywhere in the world. This is what's happened in terms of obesity in the United States. If you go back to 1994, relatively small numbers of people were obese. Most of the United States people were, the average in the individual states was less than 14% of the population of the state being obese, or between 14 and 18%. So you went to 2000 and 2008, more and more people got fatter and fatter in more and more states. And you can see now virtually the whole of the east of the United States is dark red now, which means that more than 26% of the people living in those areas are obese. You can map that very closely to the development of what we call type 2 diabetes, or non-insulin dependent diabetes. It is directly related to being fat. As you get obese, your risk of developing diabetes increases dramatically, and you can see the graphs on the bottom are changing colour, probably just behind the graphs on the top. So as people get more and more fat, following just behind, we're getting more and more instances of type 2 diabetes. We know that people who've got type 2 diabetes are at an increased risk of developing heart disease. We've known that for many, many years. That's where I started my work when I did my PhD. So we've got something going on here which is in danger of reversing that trend in our decrease in heart disease over the years. And that's a worry. But that's not the only problem. One of the things we know is even those people who are obese who don't develop full-blown diabetes very often are metabolically compromised. And what I mean by that is if you took a non-diabetic obese person and you gave them a glucose tolerance test, which is essentially just giving them a drink of glucose, very often they will manage to maintain their blood glucose within the normal levels. Let me just explain this diagram slightly. This is the normal range for non-obese people. So most of us will manage to maintain our blood glucose within this range throughout the 180 minutes following a glucose load. An obese person who isn't diabetic will usually just about also manage to stay within that same range. Maybe bumping along at the top, but they're not diabetic. They keep their glucose normal. To do that, however, they have to produce vastly more amounts of the hormone insulin than a non-obese person does. So in response to that glucose load, that's the level of blood insulin that you might see in these people. That's the level that an obese person will have to produce to keep their glucose under control. We call this insulin resistance. Now, eventually, in some of those obese people, their pancreases, which produce the insulin, will start to fail, and they won't be able to maintain that very high output. That's when they'll become diabetic. For others, they'll stay in this insulin-resistant state. And that insulin-resistant state is associated with a whole cluster of risk factors for heart disease. Slightly raised blood glucose, hypertension and increased blood pressure, and a raised level of fat, triglyceride in their blood. The good cholesterol tends to go down, so they've got low HDL cholesterol. The adipose tissue, the fat tissue, is producing a whole lot of molecules called inflammatory molecules, which make your body feel it's in a state of attack, and these inflammatory molecules could attack your artery walls and start the process of atherosclerosis, which causes heart disease. Your blood becomes more likely to clot. Having a blood clot is one of the things which leads to a heart attack. And the amount of free fatty acids that are floating around in your blood are elevated. In recent years, that cluster of risk factors has been referred to as the metabolic syndrome. And it's believed that even in obese people who aren't suffering from full-blown diabetes, many of them will have this metabolic syndrome. They're at an increased risk of heart disease, and we're in a real danger of seeing that constant drop in the number of deaths from heart disease starting to go back up again. It's all really depressing, isn't it? It gets worse. Because there's another silent thing going on in these people. And this relates to their livers. Many of you know the dangers of overconsumption of alcohol and the effect it has on your liver. It leads to what we call fatty liver. That can progress to cirrhosis. That can progress to liver failure or to liver cancer. And many alcoholics will die from liver disease. Sneaked up on us in the last 5 years, probably, to be quite honest, is the fact that this is starting to happen in people who don't drink. This is happening in people who are overweight and are insulin resistant. And as many as 20 to 30% of the population of the UK, of the US, and in most industrialised countries have been estimated to be suffering from something called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. A build-up of fat within your liver. At first, you have no idea it's happened. It doesn't have any symptoms whatsoever. It then develops into what's called steatohepatitis. That's when you might start to feel it. Your liver becomes inflamed, you may have pain. And it can lead, just like alcoholic fatty liver disease, to cirrhosis. And some real concern at the moment that we have a time bomb ticking of people who are obese, who are insulin resistant, who are developing steatosis and don't even know it, who are going to end up in hospital with liver disease because of that. So, certainly within our division, I would suggest in any department of nutrition within the country, within the world even, studying the effects of this metabolic syndrome of insulin resistance, how it develops, why is it that some obese people seem to be able to avoid it, but others actually develop it? Why do some go on from metabolic syndrome into full-blown diabetes and others don't? These are all questions that we're actively involved in. This is the model that I think most of my colleagues certainly here would agree with, that what comes first is our diet, rich in saturated fat and sucrose. That leads to an increase in weight and accumulation of adipose tissue. It's that tissue that first of all becomes resistant to the action of the hormone insulin. That then leads to a release of fatty acids into the bloodstream. Those fatty acids are then responsible for making other tissues insulin resistant, such as the liver and your muscle tissue. That resistance of it for insulin in your liver leads to this non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. All of these then go on to cause other problems, changes in your plasma lipids, high blood pressure, impaired glucose tolerance. We've got these molecules being produced by the adipose tissue, these pro-inflammatory, what are called adipocytokines. All of this then goes together to increase your risk of atherosclerosis. Or you go on to develop type 2 diabetes, and that further increases your risk of atherosclerosis. And that's the whole rather depressing picture of the effects of obesity at the moment. What we are hoping to do is to develop a good animal model of this. And that's been incredibly difficult. Most of the studies which have been done so far have been done on rodents. As I've said before, it's very hard to get a normal rat to get fat. It's very hard to get a normal mouse to get fat. If we really want to understand these processes, we do need a good animal model. And a number of us have got a grant application at the moment to study this chap. This chap is the mini pig. He's not that mini. A full-grown mini pig is about 70 kilos, so he's still quite a hefty beast, but considerably smaller, as many of you will know, than a full-blown domestic pig. Now, the pigs we actually produce to produce meat have actually been bred over the decades to be lean. And they're not a particularly good model. But these guys are much closer to their original ancestors. And they're scavengers. And they have to go through periods when there's no food available. Then they'll go through a period when there's a lot of food available. And to survive that, they'll eat a lot when there's a lot of food and live off the fat when there isn't a lot. A bit like we actually evolved. So this makes a much better model in many ways. Apart from the fact they cost about £1,000 each. What we're hoping to do is model metabolic syndrome in the mini pig and look at whether our theory as to which tissues become insulin resistant first is right. And then obviously we can then intervene with different dietary or pharmacological interventions to try and prevent obesity actually falling over into metabolic syndrome and diabetes. Okay, some more positive stuff on the actual work we're doing. I just want to go through two examples of the sort of thing that we were involved in. One is actually trying to increase the amount of good fat in our diet rather than worrying about the bad fat. And then the other one is a major research interest of many of my colleagues, and that is how what a mother eats during pregnancy can actually impact on the diseases that their offspring develop many, many years later. Good fats. Well, the one on the left, I can almost guarantee that every one of you have heard of. Omega-3s, fish oils, have been pushed at us now for at least 20 years for their potential health benefits, one of which is to reduce your risk of developing heart disease. We can go into any chemist and buy a supplement of omega-3, and indeed we know that many of our foods are specifically supplemented with it. I'll talk about that in a moment. The one on the right may be less familiar to you. This is called conjugated linoleic acid. And you can buy this in some health food stores as in a tablet form like this. But it's only in the last year that approval has now been given to actually supplement foods with conjugated linoleic acid, both in the United States and in Europe. So we may start to see milk and yogurt and things like that which have been specifically supplemented with this. But if we want to change our fat intake from diet, then what do we have to do in terms of changing the fat composition of our diet? Well, if we look where the bad fats come from, unfortunately, the majority of them come from animal products. So we've got milk and milk products on the right there, about a quarter. We've got meat and meat products on the other side, about another quarter. We've got butter there, which is only about 4% now. So if we could actually alter the fat composition of the meat, of the milk, put some of these good fats in it and replace perhaps some of the bad fats, could we actually have a much more wholesale effect on the whole health of the nation? That's what we call a fatty acid composition of normal milk. No fat has one single type of fat in it. It'll have a mixture of fats. Now, milk is thought of as bad because it has a lot of saturated fat. And that's the bars that I've shown in red there. 12-naught, 14-naught, 16-naught refers to the number of carbon atoms. The naught says there's no double bond, so it's saturated. But it does have some of the fatty acids in it as well. You've got this big greeny yellow bar there, which is the oleic acid, the monounsaturated fatty acid, which most of us believe is quite good for us. And then at the far end here, we have some good fatty acids. We have some polyunsaturated fatty acids in milk, in very small amounts. And then we have this, conjugated linoleic acid, which I mentioned, a tiny amount of it. But even though that's tiny, milk represents by far the major dietary source of this potentially good fatty acid. And over the last 20 years or so, it's been claimed that CLA, or conjugated linoleic acid, has benefits on a whole range of aspects of health. There's some really reasonably good evidence that it might be anti-carcinogenic. It may reduce the amount of fat in your body, altering nutrient partitioning. It may reduce your risk of developing diabetes. It may boost your immune system. It may improve your bone mineralization. It all seems a little bit too good to be true, and some of them, I think, won't actually turn out to be true. But repeatedly, there's evidence to suggest that it might have anti-atherogenic properties. It might reduce your risk of developing atherosclerosis. Atherosclerosis is the underlying cause of heart disease. So for a number of years, I've been working with my colleagues who are animal scientists, and this work started with Phil Garnsworthy and a PhD student of his, Adam Locke, and then progressed when Adam went to work in the States to work with somebody called Dale Bauman over at Cornell. And we can actually increase substantially the amount of CLA in our milk by changing the diet of the cow. If you give the cow some oil, some sunflower oil and a little bit of fish oil, you can increase the amount of CLA in the milk by about tenfold. So Adam and Dale did this out in Cornell. They produced this butter. They sent it over to me, and I tested it in an animal model of looking at the effect on plasma cholesterol. Story behind that, it arrived at East Midlands Airport by DHL right in the middle of summer on one of the hottest days of the year, and I was desperately waiting for it and finally got through to somebody at DHL. I said, "Oh yes, it's here, it's in the warehouse." And I was saying, "Well, can I have it?" And they're saying, "No, you can't have it till tomorrow." And I was saying, "But it'll all have melted by then." And they just couldn't understand why I was so upset about these few kilos of butter. I finally got it because a woman who worked there's husband had just had a heart attack, and when I started explaining what I was doing, she let me in. I had to go into the warehouse and get it, but otherwise none of this would have happened. The animal model I used was the hamster, and believe it or not, the hamster has many similarities to us in terms of how it carries the cholesterol in its blood. Other rodents like mice and rats aren't as good. The hamster carries quite a lot of cholesterol in the bad fraction, like us, the LDL fraction. So for many years, we've used this as a model for humans. We took groups of hamsters and we either fed them on normal butter or on CLA-enriched butter, and we got a very nice result. Total plasma cholesterol on the far left-hand side there went down. LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, went down. There was a non-significant increase in the good cholesterol, the HDL cholesterol. So our LDL-HDL ratio, which tells us how much at risk this chap might be of developing atherosclerosis, went down substantially, almost by 60%. So by increasing the amount of CLA in our butter, we actually made it a healthier product. It decreased plasma cholesterol. We're very excited about that. But there's something I didn't show you. And that was that, in fact, CLA wasn't the only thing that had changed in our butter. We also massively increased this fatty acid, so-called C18-1-trans. That's a trans fatty acid. That's what we find in hydrogenated vegetable oil. That's what we've been told for the last 10 years is the source of all evil. It's been wiped out of our food, certainly in the United States and Canada. Restaurants aren't allowed to use hydrogenated oil in cooking, and so on and so forth. So what on earth's going on? We fed a butter which was enriched in CLA, but even more enriched in trans fat, and it actually reduced cholesterol rather than increasing it. Well, basically, it turns out that the type of trans fat that we have in milk, which got through to the butter, is very, very different to the type of trans fat that we've got in hydrogenated vegetable oil. Along the bottom axis there, these are just all different, what we call isomers. The double bonding is a slightly different position in each of these isomers. And in hydrogenated fat, we have a broad range of different isomers. The red bars there show you a broad range. In our ruminant fat, in our cow, in our milk, there's one major isomer right in the middle of there, that so-called trans-11 isomer. And what seems to be emerging is this one particular trans fat might actually be good for you rather than bad, and it might be the other ones which are bad for you. Our problem now, apart from proving that it's definite, is how on earth do you get the public to understand that? They've now been told year after year that trans fat is bad for you. All of a sudden the scientists have changed their mind again. Yes, it is bad for you, but not this one. So that's going to be an effort in itself. But it might be good news for the dairy industry. Perhaps we can produce a super milk, a milk which is rich in CLA and this particular trans isomer, which may actually have health benefits. So we're hoping that that will pan out in the end. Right, but I'll speed up a bit. But fish oil, as I say, that's something you'll all be familiar with. In terms of heart disease and metabolic disease, there's a significant amount of evidence, certainly, that it reduces cardiovascular disease. It started when we discovered that Eskimos had very low incidence of heart disease until they moved to Western society. And as soon as they started eating what people ate in the rest of Canada or the rest of Scandinavia, they developed the same risk. And it seemed to be the omega-3 that was actually protecting them. More recently, it looks like it may alleviate some of the symptoms of metabolic syndrome. And even more recently, there's evidence building up that it might actually prevent or reverse this buildup of fat in the liver, the non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So the problem with this is that the ones which actually... seem to have the benefits... Sorry. Are the, what we call the very long chain ones, with lots of carbons in them, 20 or 22 carbons, and lots of double bonds. That one's got 5 double bonds in, that's got 6 double bonds in. And we really only get them from marine fish and marine mammals. And most of us have objections to eating whales and seals and things like that, therefore we only get it from fish. That's because they get into the tissues of those animals because they're part of the composition of the marine algae, which many of these, which within the food chain in the sea, they ultimately end up eating. What we do eat, however, is lots of the what we call a parent molecule. That's 18 carbons, 3 double bonds, so-called alpha-linolenic acid. And that exists in lots of our vegetable material, in many of our plants. If you go into a health food store, you'll see lots of supplements, for example, of flaxseed, which is essentially the same as linseed. And all animals have the ability to convert that C18-3 all the way through to these long chain ones. But we're not very good at it, and humans are particularly bad at it. So could we actually increase the amount of the alpha-linolenic acid in the diet of some of our farm animals and get them to convert some of it into EPA and DHA, and then we'll enrich our meat and our milk with that, and we'll actually benefit from it that way. Well, a very simple experiment we've started off with recently is just to take beef from animals which are fed either on grass, which most of us assume that they normally eat, or on what we call a concentrate diet. Concentrate diet are things like cereals, barley and things like that. And feeding concentrates to cows in particular is a very, very common practice in North America. Most of our cows get some grass at least some of the time, but in North America, concentrate diets are very common. And it changes the fatty acid composition of the meat. The major fatty acids don't change very much. So you can see palmitic acid there, just that big bar just on the left, is a saturated fat. It's very rich. We've got oleic acid. There's not much different. The changes really are down at this end. And they're vanishingly small, unless you blow it up as we have here. But in fact, what we did find was if we compared the grass-fed beef with the concentrate-fed beef, that from the grass animals had significantly more linolenic acid in, had significantly more of the EPA, that's the one with 20 carbons and 5 double bonds. It didn't actually affect the DHA, but there were changes. Now, are those changes enough to have an impact on the effect of the beef on heart disease? A different mouse model this time. This is a transgenic mouse. It contains a human gene. And that human gene is a mutant of a gene that we normally have, called ApoE, which causes people to develop hyperlipidemia, high plasma cholesterol, and have an increased risk of heart disease. And if we put this gene into these animals, they will also develop hyperlipidemia. They'll also develop atherosclerosis. They won't keel over and have a heart attack, but it's a good model. So we fed these mice our beef from either our grass or our concentrate-fed cows. And I was quite surprised, because the differences in the composition were very small, but we got an effect. We didn't get an effect on plasma cholesterol, but plasma triglyceride, the other major fat in the blood, was lower in the grass-fed animals than the concentrate-fed animals. Increased triglyceride is part of the metabolic syndrome. So we got quite excited. Have we actually managed to reduce atherosclerosis just by changing eating beef from grass-fed animals compared to concentrate? Unfortunately not. The difference wasn't big enough. What you see on that side is a cross-section through the aorta, the major artery of the mouse. And the red bit where it says lesion, that is the start of an atherosclerotic plaque. That's the start of the clogging up of the artery. So these animals develop atherosclerosis. But the difference in the diets was not enough to actually give us a significant difference in the development of atherosclerosis. And where that work's going now is to try and further increase the N3 or even the 18-4 content of the diet of the cow to load that meat with more of these precursors with the hope that we might be able to have an effect. So that potentially, again, we could produce beef which could be advertised as being potentially healthier. Right, get rid of what? Ultimate transgenics. If I can persuade Keith Campbell to get involved, then perhaps we can go all the way and produce a true hybrid between our fish and our cow and produce something which is even healthier. Final thing I just want to say a little bit about is one of the major research interests of the whole of our division and beyond the division within the university. And that's so-called fetal programming, or the developmental origins of health and disease. And this all goes back to what was called the Barker hypothesis, which suggested that fetal undernutrition in middle to late gestation leads to a disproportionate growth in fetal growth and programs later coronary heart disease. David Barker in Southampton came up with that in the mid-90s. It has its origins much earlier on, however, and the data that David Barker used to actually predict this, a lot of it was historical. And this is the one which is the nicest story in many ways, and it relates to what was called the Dutch hunger winter during the Second World War. And for a while in Holland, Germany barricaded the movement of all food into areas of Holland. And people within that area were literally starving to death. They had very little food. They were eating tulip bulbs, they were eating candle wax and all sorts of things. But it was a relatively small period of time. Then the Allied troops got in, they airlifted food in, they dropped it, and liberated them finally. During that period of the Dutch famine, there was a number of women who were obviously pregnant. And good records have been kept ever since then, all the way through to what happened to their offspring. And it was quite surprising. Those women who were very early on in their pregnancy during the famine, their offspring had an increased rate of obesity, particularly the women. They had a more atherogenic lipoprotein profile. Their LDL cholesterol, their bad cholesterol was up, their HDL cholesterol was down, and indeed they developed more heart disease. Those women who were later on in the pregnant when the famine happened, their offspring were more likely to develop diabetes and impaired glucose tolerance. So what happened way back then in the 1940s to these women when they were pregnant impacted on what their offspring in the 1960s, 70s, 80s and 90s were actually dying of. And that's what fetal programming is, and that's been a major interest. And certainly Simon Langley Evans has been at the forefront of this for many years. He worked in Southampton when all of this was emerging and developed a whole range of animal models to look at the effect. And we can confirm in these animal models that insults during pregnancy, nutritional insults during pregnancy, can have an impact on many risk factors for heart disease in the offspring. One of the experiments more recently that Simon and I did, however, showed that you can also program other aspects of metabolism. And this is an effect on this non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. These were rats The mothers were fed either a normal diet or a low-protein diet. The offspring were born. They were just fed a normal diet, and we kept them for up to 18 months. For the first 9 months of their lives, there was nothing really different between them. By the time they reached old age, and 18 months is old age for a rat, those from the mothers on the low-protein diet developed what we call steatosis, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. All these little white holes on the bottom picture there are where the fat was in their liver compared to the normal animals up there. So it's not only about what you eat, what your mother ate can also impact on your susceptibility to these diseases. So if your mother had a nutritional insult of some sort and then you get obese, your risk of developing steatosis or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease could be increased substantially. More recently, and perhaps more relevantly, another group, again down in Southampton, has shown you get the same thing happening if the mother was fed a high-fat diet during pregnancy. Now, that's the natural experiment we've got going on at the moment. We've got more and more obese mothers giving birth. What's going to be the consequence of that for their offspring? If this is right, then they're potentially at risk of metabolic disease, including this non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. How does it happen? How can what your mother ate be impacting on what happens to you 40, 50, 60 years later? Exciting suggestion is it's something to do with what's called epigenetics. And when all else fails, go to Wikipedia, even though I tell all my students off for using it. What is epigenetics? In essence, it's changes in the expression of your genes, which produce all the proteins in your body, which regulate everything your body does, which doesn't change the genetic code. The chemical modifications to how that genetic code is read, but you're not changing, it's not a mutation, it's not changing the genetic code. And it appears there are critical times when you're in the womb that if your mother's diet changes, Kevin Sinclair, for example, has got some data showing that B vitamins can have similar effects, that can change the chemical structure of your DNA. And that can carry on all the way through your life and impact on what diseases you're going to die of. So perhaps that's an excuse to say, well, I can't do anything about it. It was all down to my mother anyway, and we're stuck with what we've got. But more importantly, obviously, it's research in this area is vital to look at what we're doing to our offspring by the change in our diet that we're seeing. Thank you. I'm sorry that went on a bit longer, as usual. I should thank all of my colleagues in nutritional sciences and leave you with the thought that you are in the good hands in the dedicated scientists who are in nutritional sciences. We're all behind our leader in the middle there who's up for world domination. As you can see, you've got most of the senior members of staff there. I should point out that was Red Nose Day, so not a normal day there. And I wouldn't have put it in if I'd known Mike was filming it, so I might have to doctor the film before I do. Thank you very much. Let's not leave it on that one.